appeal of the permit for community house. That happened in, I guess, February of 1996. And when the appeal was turned down and the city ramrodded through the community house project, in spite of environmental concerns, in spite of opposition from homeless groups, in spite of the fact that it was taking up space which was not going to be available for a homeless campground, and no homeless campground was contemplated, the city council made numerous token gestures that went nowhere, little committees that were looking for a campground. Citizens Committee is, for the homeless, is getting all the gravy, as has been pointed out, and yet at the same time, their finances have been in real disarray. They have an audit that has been postponed month after month after month. There was a scandalous stories in the Sentinel which were actually used to destroy the career of Frank Pusilek, who was a man who actually supported a campground for homeless people, a man who actually was trying to put together something, even though there was a lot of political opposition from the city council. Instead, what you have now is city council members incestuously joining the board of CCH and then covering up malfeasance, refusing to advocate for homeless people, and instead sort of proceeding in a smiling manner to say, everything's okay, Jane, it's all right, Jack. I'm talking about Catherine Byers, who's on the board of CCH, and Celia Scott, who was previously on the board of CCH. So when you come to city council, they won't say a word against community house. They will not acknowledge any criticism of it. And when you go to their meetings of CCH, they are not interested in opening up campground space. So it's sort of like you're locked out at both gates. But let me ask you about that matter. I understand Frank Pusilek is now suing out of the city or CCH for damages that he suffered because of the failure of CCH, well, actually, specific actions by CCH that were, they didn't cover their ass, they covered their ass, but they didn't cover his ass, or they covered his ass with shame. Anyway, what happened with that?
Oh, gosh. I'm not aware of any lawsuit having been filed as of this time.
I know a claim against the city was filed.
By Frank Pusilek?
Yeah, it had to be filed by August 1st, I believe.
Oh.
And Kate Wells was the attorney who did that.
Oh, I'm not aware about the claim against the city.
They're not mentioning this to the board members, as if we know about it at all.
And that's another aspect of CCH. Much of the action in CCH happens behind the scenes, concealed not merely from the members, not merely from the board of directors, but from the executive board, which is a small subcommittee of the board of directors on which you sit, right, Becky Johnson?
Which hasn't met since I became a member of the executive board, to my knowledge.
Or perhaps they've met and they haven't told you.
Right.
Well,
really, what? I mean, I believe that's what we know, is that they're meeting and they're not inviting Becky because she is a member of the executive board. And
I don't have any evidence of that. I don't have any notes of any meetings. No one's told me there was
right.
a meeting that I missed.
So I'll say it.
No, I really don't know. I don't know either.
The executive
but
board habitually would meet an hour before the Citizens Committee for the Homeless. And that happened almost every meeting throughout the fall of last year. Now, for us to say that that is not happening now, and that they're just sort of throwing it together in a spontaneous and instinctive way when they get into the room, maybe. I haven't been attending the board meetings.
Well, Mike Wilker, who chaired his last meeting on the 28th, and our board was unable to come up with another candidate who was willing to chair CCH at this point in time. And as part of his enticement was he told the board that last month he only spent 2 hours in his capacity as board chair. Now, I hope that's not the 2 hours he was chairing the meeting that he's talking about. I hope there were at least 2 additional hours he spent on CCH business.
This is Wilker, real change, not spare change, throw little yellow pieces of paper at the homeless Wilker.
The Reverend Mike Wilker.
This is the Reverend kick homeless advocates off the board of directors Wilker, this guy.
Well,
smiling with a club behind his back, Mike.
Mike,
you're a polite man. Anyway.
Well, I've seen another side of him that was less polite, but didn't occur at a board meeting.
So, before we leave Community House, I'd also like to mention that they're looking for a lot of volunteer work to get this going, but there also will be some paid positions, and I had suggested that they find homeless folk who desperately need jobs and work to be hired. And Dr. Alan Bayer, who is an anti-homeless pig, and also a board member. He's continuously making anti-homeless statements. I have no idea why he's on the board, what the hell he's doing on that board. But he seems to feel like, you know, he didn't say this in so many words, so it was a little more polite, that homeless people are too flaky or drunk or whatever to get it together to be good workers. And if they want to bid on the job, then they're welcome to, but that he's not going to discriminate or, favor. He's not going to favor.
No affirmative action for homeless people.
Right, exactly. You know, just because you're homeless doesn't mean that you should get the job over some other, upstanding Christian, or I don't know what his fucking trip is. But anyway, I really think that that's something. If there's no other reason to show up at the board meetings, if you do any kind of construction or gardening, show up at the board meetings and say, I'm ready to work, they're going to pay good wages, and I'd like to see those jobs go to some homeless people. And so, if you guys don't show up, then it's just going to go to some beer-drinking tobacco
guy with,
I don't know.
Guy with a garage.
Right.
And a condo. Let me ask you this. Do you think that if, I know that you're in your, eighth month of pregnancy, so you're not really out there with a lot of, steam on your feet. But the question is, could somebody maybe circulate a list to homeless people to bring back to the board, maybe even demanding or petitioning or imploring the board to hire homeless people instead of, others?
There's so many ideas that I get that I wish that I could do, and I can't do the footwork. I don't have the time. I'm sleeping all the time, etc. But really, God,
that would be a good idea?
It would be a good idea just to get some kind of a flyer out there that people knew that there would be jobs available for people to show up, a number for them to call. But yeah, that would be a good idea.
So if anybody wants to help with this, give a call to 423-4833 if you'd like to be Laura's legs or... help in that regard.
Well, I have a suggestion. If there are homeless people that are interested in getting jobs working on this, on the construction of community house, contact brand new board member Diane Lowe. She's on the community house subcommittee, and she seems to be someone who has an ear that's willing to listen.
Do you have a phone number for her?
So for folks who want to get in touch with that sympathetic CCH board member, Laura, what can they perhaps leave a message on your voicemail?
457-9754, extension 208.
Repeat that number, could you?
457-9754, extension 208. And if you forget the number, just call the Community Action Board number that it's the homeless voicemail number that everybody has, and punch in the last four numbers, Tucker, T-U-C-K, and you'll get it that way also.
And can also call you if they have concerns about... the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, or concerns about maybe they want to help, or maybe they're looking for work. Is this stuff you can pass on to the board, assuming you're not in the throes of labor? Or?
I really would welcome any calls. I don't get any. And also, complaints about the ISSP program, or questions about, anything. I mean, I've been homeless for over a year now, and, I know where to get voicemail and showers and food and all that, too. Of course, you can talk to other homeless people about that, but I'm just saying, I'm a good resource and a good place to complain to, a good place to... If you have stories about, trying to get shelter, Paul Brindell needs that. I have different... Yeah, I can go ahead and... There's a lot of networking that I wish people would utilize me
for.
What's
that number again?
457-9754, extension 208.
Okay, well, also, while we're at this, you actually have been apparently cooperating with and getting some cooperation from Homeless Community Resource Director Karen Gillette, who, of course, runs the showers and has a kind of a counseling and some job services and phone and so forth. And actually, it's the place where homeless people are... allowed to go to during the day. That's sort of the out-of-the-way side scene. Some people have called it the ghetto area, but it certainly is a service center where people can come to, they get food and so forth, free meals. And she recently has been helpful in supporting you as you, I guess you were trying to get people to call in about the shelter shortage, and you were working with the Community Action Board Director Paul Brindell on the shelter shortage stuff. And you were having people call a phone, and we were having people call a phone number on that issue so that people could know that there was inadequate shelter. One of the things the city council has been claiming is that nobody, everybody who wants shelter gets it, and the rest of them, well, that's just how it goes.
Yeah, and really what we want is not only if you've looked for shelter and have been turned down or have found shelter and then said screw it and split for some reason, which really happens a lot, so we want to know why you don't like the shelter that's available, or also there's really, which is just as legitimate, there's a lot of people that don't want to stay at a church on a hard floor. They'd rather find a nice bush underneath the stars somewhere and risk getting a ticket. And we want to hear from you guys too. Or maybe you've got a good running vehicle that you sleep in and you drive out to Davenport or whatever, you know, and you don't have to give your name. You can stay anonymous. Nobody's going to knock on your door in the middle of the night. We just want a tally of how many people really are out there that are homeless, why they don't use the shelter systems, or the ones that have looked, why they've been turned down. Maybe you like to have a beer at night and you can't do that. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons that city council may not consider legitimate that actually are legitimate in my view, and so we just want a tally of everybody so that we can bring that to city council and say there, you know, there's this many people out there that have looked for shelter and haven't been able to get in or refuse to go to the shelter because they don't like it for one reason or another. Maybe you're a vet that doesn't want to be inside. You can't be inside. There's all kinds of different reasons why people don't utilize the shelter programs, which of course are too meager anyway. It may just be that you know that there's none available, so screw it, you know. But anyway, call 457-9754. Extension 555 and leave a message.
And if all these numbers get a little confusing and you can't remember any other number, give a call to 423-4833 and that's HUF headquarters, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom.
No, call my number.
And I'll try to help. Rumors that the Homeless Community Resource Center is kind of being called in by the city, actually not just rumors, there were actual meetings that were being held to kind of shore up CCH in the event that it goes down like a beached whale. And CCH now is in better financial condition, but I think that there are some people in the city like manager Dick Wilson who don't like CCH much and don't like its community house project and so forth. Kind of we share that. We both don't like it too much. But let's get on to the really important subject, the armories, winter shelter. Becky, anything you want to say about that? Did CCH have an emergency crisis meeting to expand the ISSP to deal with this winter shelter emergency, or possibly to ask city council to overturn the sleeping ban during that period?
Well, nothing about the sleeping ban, of course, but of course, it was the major concern that I had for that meeting was, what are we going to do now that the armories are not going to be available next winter? And since Citizens Committee for the Homeless is the majority shelter provider for homeless people in terms of temporary emergency shelter in the city of Santa Cruz, I thought it was our job to come up with some sort of plan for what to do, or at least start discussing what we're going to do. However, the ISSP report came very late in the meeting. Mike Wilker had left. He turned over the chairmanship to Reverend Jim Lapp, and when I attempted to to raise that issue, he cut me off rather abruptly, said, I'm going to move on and I'm not going to recognize you, and he moved on to the next item on the agenda, which was a motion to adjourn.
So you were essentially muzzled again, as you often are at CCH when you try to bring up these issues. I mean, weren't you trying like 4 or 5 months ago to bring up a safe haven when people were coming out of the armory and had no legal shelter this spring and summer and have had no legal shelter other than 28 spaces for more than 750 homeless people? You tried to do something and
we were told that because construction was going to begin April 1st, it wouldn't be feasible to put a temporary...
Construction on community house?
Yes. This is last April 1st we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And here it is, September 1st today, or
August 31st
today,
yeah.
And construction has not begun. They're hoping, in fact, they have to start construction October 1st, but obviously the field has been available all this time and Safe Haven could have gone in.
Indeed, and in fact they have this fluid construction date that I have seen. The first construction date I heard, of course, was January 1st, 1992. That was why they had to arrest us out of the field in October of 1991 to make sure that the field could be properly prepared for community house. The point is, and the huge hypocrisy behind all this is the Citizens Committee for the Homeless. And they are, of course, destroying the rights and removing the shelter of homeless people in order to set up a transitional housing program that gets a lot of funding from the federal government and can be a little showcase plum for the city council.
Well, I would have liked to have suggested to the board. Now I either have to do this informally or wait a month. Thank you, Jim Lapp, and all the homeless people. Thank you, Jim Lapp. But one thing we could easily do is expand the ISSP program and take more people in it. That could be an immediate first step that we could do in light of the fact that the armories will not be available this winter.
I think to Wendy Butler's credit, she did talk about that and has already done.
Wendy Butler is the head of the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program?
The ISSP program.
The emergency shelter program that takes people on church floors every
year. And Becky and I were both disappointed in her response to Pete Wilson's shutting down the armory. She seems a little delusional on that subject. She thinks the fat lady hasn't sung yet and that he's still listening. The fat lady has sung, he's not listening. But anyhow,
I would say the thin man has sneered.
Yes. And anyway, but she is already working on a backup plan to get more churches involved and has already looked at the budget to see how the vans are going to, she needs an extra van and this. And anyway, she's already is working on expanding
there's a concern because some of the funding that we have for the armory might not be applicable for a church program.
Yeah, there's a lot of problems, and of course we have a severe El Nino-style winter predicted, as well as food stamp cutoffs that are coming in September for immigrants and children, and the ongoing pressure and cuts of the welfare decapitation program of Clinton that has now, of course, been ratified by the California State Legislature after a sellout deal by some of the centrist Democrats in that legislature. Now is Housing Now! Santa Cruz activist Linda LeMaster. And Linda, you've been homeless on and off for the last 20 years. You're a mom. People know you. Police reports contain your name. We won't get into that.
Thank
now.
You. My name pops up. Who knows where these days?
And so you actually haven't heard much of our prior discussion, but what's happening with welfare that people need to know about?
Well, in the AFDC or Family Department, the County Human Resources Agency's Welfare Department is going to be talking to the County Board of Supervisors about the plan for here, for about 5,000, 4,000 people in this county here. And it's slated for the 16th of September right now. I suppose these things can change at the last minute, but you can find out each Friday before what the Tuesday Board of Supervisors meeting is going to be, or catch the Monday evening meeting some of them have.
So you're saying folks should go to that Tuesday Board of Supervisors on September 16th?
Yes, and also line up support prior to that. I think equally important is making phone calls to them, and whether you've seen the county's plan or whether you haven't, whether your own welfare or whether you're not, or maybe especially if you're part of a church or a middle class structure and you're not on family welfare, call them before the 16th. If you call them before 3 or 4 days before their meeting, they might even
get... What should you tell them?
Tell them what their need needs to be to support a family. The county has to tell them how to somehow squeeze into the county's budget things that the state and federal government used to pay for. They're talking like somehow they're going to meet the state's mandate that 80% of the families on the present AFDC system will get employed in less than a year and a half. And it's kind of like, it seems to me kind of like a horse race that, you know, the counties lose money if they can't push people into jobs. It doesn't matter if these jobs are ruining their lives, wrecking their cars, causing not just 12-year-olds, but 2, 3, 4, 5-year-olds to be neglected, because these other welfare systems that pick up when things break down are getting more money. In other words, there's incentives for the welfare infrastructure, even at the county level. But there aren't a hell of a lot of incentives for families that are going to be like real supports to get them into jobs that will work, that will be viable.
Simpler English for me, I'm kind of a dummy.
Well, and plus you haven't had that kind of a family structure to have to support recently without any resources. I don't think it's dumb or smart. I think it's just people are naive until you try to get $10 worth of food with 50 cents. What it boils down to is, the county is going to try to find ways to get what they call pilot programs or models that will get them a little extra money. And of course, we are a small county. We're not the only county that's going to be gambling in this way. So it's sort of like now the state bureaucracy is doing the same thing that the state legislature did 2 weeks ago, and sort of doling out what they're chopping up in terms of family resources. They're trying to do it in a way. These county incentives are to keep from losing too many bureaucrat jobs, like, say, eligibility workers, the person you got to report whether you have any car or not and whether you're surviving or not, to every month.
Also, how resourceful do you think these families are going to have to be to find these programs? Are they going to be readily available, or?
The programs I'm talking about are hypothetical right now. That's why I feel it's important that people get in touch with the County Board of Supervisors, and even if they can handle it, with the head of the Welfare Department.
Again, what kinds of things do you think they should be telling the Board of Supervisors?
I have an idea. I think the county should define child care and motherhood as a job and call that those people are employed.
Yeah.
I think that's a very good position. I think we have to get out of this bickering over dimes when dollars and houses are needed and start talking about what it really takes to support a family. And we need to go nose to nose with some of these supervisors individually, because otherwise they'll be like the state legislature. They won't deal with anything real. You know, like one of the things the state did is decide, well, if these families can't hack it in the job world the way we want them to do it, then we're going to cut off the mommy part of the welfare and just give them the children part. So we don't want to hurt the children. What a bunch of bullshit. Well, the AFDC grant doesn't even pay for the housing for the mommy and child in this county and in most of the state, you know?
Well, how can you hurt the mom without hurting the child? That's so ludicrous.
Yeah, it's kind of philosophically absurd, too. But even if all you can understand is the fiscal bottom line, it's still stupid, and we have to get them to think about the real thing, what's happening to children, what's happening to people, what's happening to families and community. And there's nothing pressuring the county to even take that into account except the little voice at the Women's Commission. So it's up to individuals. So if you know some kids that are already having a rough time, you need to convey that to the County Board of Supervisors. And I think constructive ideas, even if you think they might not be simple or viable, need to be articulated and fast.
Well, I think, again, maybe you could propose a few ideas that people could call in with, because yeah, I'd like to hear those specifically.
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind, because I live in a neighborhood that's getting all this so-called redevelopment money, is to pressure the local governments to stop gentrifying the neighborhoods that they're supposed to be upgrading and take some affirmative, aggressive action about low-income and affordable housing. In our county, if that piece isn't in place, there's no way that a mommy or a daddy is going to be successful at work in parenting their children. And meanwhile, there are infrastructures in the state and the federal government, mostly by negligence at the federal level, and locally, like, for example, the camping ban or the new youth curfew, that push people into criminalization for formerly innocent behavior that they're not even going to know about until they're in the middle of some two policemen frisking them or something. That's how this stuff is going to be found out by most families, because they don't have time to sit around and read the paper or sort through the lies on the radio or something. So that's how they're going to find out, at least in my neighborhood.
Not on our show, of course.
I have more faith in random media than commercial media, but nonetheless, there's a lot to be
said. Random media, well.
There's a lot to be said for checking things out yourself. Don't believe what you read in the paper, and try to get in touch with the Board of Supervisors before the 16th. Otherwise, the only recommendations you're going to have are from the county, which have to do with how to make it look like paper pushers are social workers.
Any other suggestions you think people should bring to the board before the 16th? Or perhaps you'll be bringing to the board?
I'm going to tell my friends on the 16th to bring their children. And Sandy Brown is a good resource. She works for the Fair Share Network, who has lobbied the legislature, somehow managing to get, 16 senators and assemblymen not to vote for welfare reform out of 300 representatives or something.
I mean welfare deform.
Yeah, I don't mean to say welfare reform is reform. I slipped into using their word for it. There's nothing reformative about it. It's a criminalization like much other new legislation in this country.
You've got a list of topics. Are there other things you want to bring to the attention of the folks?
Yeah, I'm personally worried about general assistance. General assistance is entirely county-run and county-funded. And a lot of counties, including ours, kind of base the amount
of... What is general assistance for those who don't know?
Okay, it's like the bottom line social service safety net for indigent adults. And they really mean indigent in this case, folks. You have to prove you don't even have the bus fare to get over there to apply for it, but you can't be more than 15 minutes late for your appointment in order to qualify. So the county has also made recommendations saying, we want you to change this and that, and it'll save $1,000 here and $3,000 there, and maybe on the good side, pick up a few people that the federal government's SSI program has kicked off. And some of the people that are getting kicked off because the county doctors, the county health service agency, and the county welfare bureaucracy have gotten them on SSI based on, quote, a medical diagnosis, end quote, of drug and alcohol abuse, ignoring their other health care needs, because as everybody who's had to go to the county Emmeline Street County Medical Clinic, they only dole out pills, and you have to wait a long time before they figure out what your name is and whether they can help you, even in that, I think, dangerous way. So people can go in there with a broken back and come out with 2 months of GA and ultimately a couple years of SSI for an alcohol and drug problem, because that's the only thing they can get treatment for, because that's this year's fad to get state money. Meanwhile, their medical problem remains, and they're stuck in this downward spiral of self-medication.
And of course, SSI for drug and alcohol abuse was re-examined at the beginning of this year and cut off for a lot of people, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then it included almost 1,000 people in our county, and a few of them are going to get put back on SSI. For example, legal aliens that have worked a whole lot of Social Security hours or legit jobs.
In SSI the is the federal program, of course, that has to do with aid to people who are ill or disabled, right?
Who are seriously disabled for at least more than a year, who can't work at all for at least more than a year. For most of us, that means have a complex of disabilities. Mm-hmm. But if you live through the year that you're having to indicate you can't work and manage to get on the SSI, it's much more streamlined than the other public benefit programs. Now, of course, I'm talking about the past history up to this time, as all these programs are being gutted as we speak and have been in the case of Social Security and federal welfare, have been for the past year, and in the county have been totally dumped upside down in the past month. Anyway, so people who might have been getting by because they were getting SSI or Social Security payments and who have been cut off this year because of these federal turnarounds, they would be eligible for general assistance, but if there are no advocates on their behalf, they might be eligible for GA only for 3 months in the future, or 3 months out of every year, or something terribly inane like that. And more important, the general assistance, the county makes it hard to get. So I know of people who have died trying to get it. I myself walked Lotus through that system when we had a driver from Santa Cruz to Watsonville to be chewed out by a lady who didn't even introduce herself, just to give you an indication of the beginning of how it is to get GA. I'm very critical of the mean-spiritedness of it. I understand that the county is a little tighter with county dollars than they are with dollars that come from a little bit of everywhere, but they don't have to be mean about it to be stingy. I wanted to mention, too, something about the armory politics. Although this might not interest everybody, hopefully it'll motivate somebody.
About the armory winter shelter program we were discussing before. The county is primary winter shelter, kind of compulsory. You got to be in by 4, out by 5 in the morning. Don't bring your vehicle, don't bring your dog, don't bring your partner, sort of thing.
Don't bring a life. I mean, you have to be like less than a child to fit your life into the bus schedule for this place. But on the other hand, it is an inexpensive way to get a roof over your head, and they're predicting a very terrible winter. And of course, the governor picked this El Nino-tainted winter to be the most mean he's been every time they've asked, well, please, can we have the armories that are sitting there empty all the time? One more year or two more years? So finally, somehow, the governor says, yes, I will not stop you from using the armories for the coming 2 years, but I am going to strike the funding for it. So, and I've already lobbied the National Guardsmen, who are uptight anyway, because they think it's their building, and it's it sounds like dogs and cats and territory to me, but anyway, so it's impossible for the state to help with the funding, which in the past has paid for a little bit of monitoring and cleaning. In our county, by the way, people in some of the churches that support the ISSP, Interfaith Satellite Shelter Project, which uses the armory as its the biggest number of beds of the sites it uses in its musical chairs shelter system. People who have brought the dinners say that the homeless people themselves clean up after themselves, monitor themselves, have meaningful interaction with the people from the churches who bring soup or whatever. Sometimes you get a meal. And there's a cooperative spirit. And even though they got to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, I couldn't do it. They'd kick me out. They'd think I was drunk because I wake up crabby sometimes, but that wouldn't last. But anyway, so this is what the people who support the armory system here in our county say, is that the empowerment that goes on in that program now is going to be eliminated if the governor's new rules, like money has to come from local sources to pay outsiders, like, say, First Alarm.
You know, First Attack Security?
Yeah. It's private security agents like the ones that we recruit the hosts from here will have to be hired if the money's raised locally, not out-of-state budgets, for cleanup, for monitoring all night, and the armory guys, the National Guardsmen, need money too. So, in other words, he's created 7 or 8 new blockades to being able to use the armory while saying, okay, you can have them open for another 2 years. This is clearly a lobbied politic issue, and to me it's stupid to have any place that's vacant at night closed when people are outside dying of cold or getting soggy.
Neil Kennedy's bookstore, take note.
I don't mean to single anyone out in this town. There's businesses that are empty day and night, and people sleeping outside and dying because of it. And until they're right on the divider line in the middle of the highway, a lot of Americans are not going to see people that they're killing die. And people like Jane Emma have to go down to the coroner's office because nobody else knows who these people are until after they're dead.
Someone died of an overdose yesterday on the path to Denny's, a homeless man found with a needle in his arm, according to activist Michael Sheridan. Not only, of course, our services being cut back, but our entitlements and so forth, but there's the whole situation of medical treatment for the poor. Do you have any comments on that? I know one of your friends has recently one of our friends has gone through a crisis, Lotus Maynor, who was, of course, the head of the union, Santa Cruz Union for the Homeless in 1992, and has been working with Welfare Parents Low Income Support Network for a while, for a long time. And she's had a crisis, and apparently she got some pretty shabby treatment at Dominican. Any comments on that and on treatment generally of poor people by Dominican Hospital and medical services in this county?
I can't make general comments that really come from a lot of different people, but I'd like to put my phone number out as a way to help document the kind of experiences people might have. I'm not sure it's a secure line, but I keep good notes of all calls, and that might come in handy for some people in the future. Regarding services, if you're in this county's SHOW program, which is the Medi-Cal fake HMO, and either you're having a really good experience or a really bad experience or a really weird experience, I'd like to know about it and help get this documented and relayed to places where any difference, if there is any difference, can be made. I mean, until Lois told me this story, I hadn't heard anything quite so terrible. But in effect, she told me that she went to a hospital. She was handled, in effect, by about 7 or 8 different people in the process, not counting a cab driver that took her home. It was pretty mad because she couldn't get in and out of his car. And basically, she said, out of those 7 or 8 people, there were 2 who were humane and had an attitude of concern for her suffering. She had several disabilities already, and then she had an injury, and she could not stand or even shift her position. And the doctor himself, who usually, I mean, even in the best of situations, when you go to the emergency room, you get a few seconds with the doctor, and a half hour later, a nurse comes in to implement whatever he came up with. And in the SHOW program, it's not a discussion or a dialogue. You have to take whatever they dish out. I mean, that's a given, and I don't feel good about that, but I guess it's going on all over the country right now. Anyway, so the the doctor yanks her already torn leg further into whatever sprain or fracture was going on and sends her home, not even with any concern for pain medicine. And that was consistent with the attitude and behavior of the other people she described. What I want to share is that this has to do with another of the emergency sheltering programs here, the Shelter Project. While much of the year the Shelter Project doesn't have money, when it does, it's able to put people who, for whom it's really, really inappropriate, like you have highly communicable tuberculosis or something, so it's really, really inappropriate for you to go to the armory or the kind of crowded shelters.
And there's no armory now anyway. So.
Right. Or the church floor or whatever. You know,
there's no church floor
what
now
I'm
anyway.
Saying is you put a bunch of people in a room that was designed for three or four people, and if any one of them are sick, voila, by morning they're all sick. And it might just be the flu or some kind of terrible diarrhea that only kills a few of them, or tuberculosis. But some people should not be put in that. And it's what I'm talking about is there's a provision for the public safety. And for the sake of everyone else, those people therefore might be eligible when there's funding for a motel voucher. Doesn't happen very often. But through the Shelter Project, 457-1741, ask for Anita or Paul. When their funding is there, and if you're in that bad of a shape, they can place you in a motel sometimes for a week. So this is what happened to Lourdes. On her way to and from the hospital, she's trying to get off the street, right? Because she can't stand up or sit down anyway. And granted, it's Labor Day weekend and hotels are at their extortionist best, so I was amazed that they found something, and at the Shelter Project they found something quickly. But now she's stuck in this motel and she can't reach anything that she needs, like the light or the bathroom or even the TV, to drown out the drug-pushing neighbors. And I need people who might know her, who are listening to this, to give her a call. Because here's the deal. I don't know whether to be mad at the Shelter Project, the hotel, which is, what's it called?
Westwind Motel.
Yeah, it's also the Sea Breeze or something like that.
Changed its name recently, but they're under both names.
It's at 204 2nd Street. Or the whole damn poor people killing, mendacious attitude of people that are running things. I don't know where to put this, but for her to make a phone call out, she has to first put a $10 deposit on the telephone, and then it costs $1 for the first minute of her call and $2 for each additional 3 minutes of her phone call to call anyone. And if you're poor in the first place, that means you don't have a phone. It's just sitting there.
Change Paul Brundell for some of that.
Well, I think we should spare change everybody, but what I want to say on the radio is that those people who have a phone, maybe if they know her, call her, or if they think they can help her. I mean, she needs hot food. She needs people to make phone calls about getting her future permanent housing moving. She needs transportation almost every day. Actually, she's stuck. She shouldn't even move for 3 or 4 days, but very soon she's going to need some mobility. And people can offer her that, but she can't even call up to get it right now. She's good at that. She's willing to advocate for herself as well as all the other people that she knows, but no phone. So I would like people to try calling her. The motel is 426-7878. I can't give you the room number because they're having her play musical rooms or something. But hopefully she'll end up with a real kitchenette. And in my opinion, and I hope real people are listening to the radio this morning this far, in my opinion, that rooms should not be charged at a rate that includes a kitchenette. When what they mean by a kitchenette is a microwave and a broken 2-cubic-foot refrigerator, one on top of the other with cockroaches behind it. Not a kitchenette.
Give that number again for Lourdes Maynard.
Okay, it's 426-7878.
426-7878, folks. So grab that and write that down. If you want to give Lourdes a call, she can talk to you about her experiences. If she's conscious when you give her a call, she's in kind of some pain.
She told me she wants to document her experience with the hospital, and somebody needs to track down the cab driver and get his statement if it's going to do any good. But first and foremost, I think she needs contact with the outside because she's kind of stuck right now.
Right. Well, another, of course, defect at the hospital was that Though an ambulance brought her in, they forced her to leave in a taxi cab, which she took, 15 minutes to get to and from? She was in such pain?
Well, it takes three of us to lift her in and out of the thing because she couldn't use a whole leg.
They gave her a knee brace that fell off. They put her in a wheelchair that couldn't be fit into the place she was living in. She can barely get to the bathroom and does so with great pain and difficulty. And in case you think this is just sort of some special pleading for a friend of ours, and she is a friend of ours, this show is concerned with the situation that anybody would face if they went to Dominican, and probably does. Any other cases you want to mention at this point?
Not in terms of specific people, but I need to know if people that are entitled to the Medi-Cal benefits aren't getting them, because there's ways that some of us who have had to deal with that system can be supportive either to the individual or it in some way influence future outcomes better.
In order to contact Linda with your discussion of Medi-Cal and your needs and how they have or haven't been met, her number is 423-HOME, H-O-M-E, 423-HOME. It's Home versus Huff here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. That's what you're listening to, Bathrobe Spears, Broadside, Civil Rights for the Poor. We're actually going to try to expand this show to an extra hour this weekend since we have so much material. Don't know if we're going to be able to do that, but stay tuned. We'll see if the friendly folks at Free Radio Santa Cruz are going to let us get into their hip-hop time. Another plug for the political event that's happening at the Veterans Hall today. That's from noon to midnight. It's run by a lot of people, but its guiding spirit is attorney Ed Fry, who has been fighting for the rights of cannabis users, fighting for the rights of homeless people, and engaged in attempts to bring the community together to discuss local issues and to challenge political corruption. He's twice run for district attorney against our incumbent district attorney, Art, lock him up and prosecute him to death, Danner. And I encourage you to come down to the Veterans Building and check this out. There's going to be music, going to be dancing, going to be talking. Who knows what else there's going to be. And the Veterans Building, for those of you who don't know, is at Pacific and Front Streets, right there across from the town clock, right near the post office at the top of the mall. There are going to be some guest speakers. Ann Turner from the San Jose Community Homeless Alliance. And one of these days we should play you the tape of the demonstration that we had over there in San Jose supporting San Jose homeless's really difficult situation with the new sit-lie law. It's illegal to sit down in San Jose anywhere downtown except in the park, and after dark you're out of luck down there. And of course there's no shelter. Their police are attacking people in cars, arresting them for sleeping there. She'll be talking about stuff around that issue. This is going to be, in fact, you can come and talk. That's one of the points made by host Ed Fry, who said he doesn't want to have special speakers. Everybody's going to get a chance to dialogue with everybody else, to air issues in the community that folks are concerned about. So come on down. That's noon to midnight tonight. Also featured at that, well, not featured, but present at that rally is going to be the couple John Hernandez and Leslie Scales, recently back from the North Coast. These are headwaters and homeless activists who lost their son last week. Forrest died, and we're hearing from them, an interview with them that will be broadcast on KSCO, hopefully, although you get to hear it here first. Here's John and Leslie talking about Forrest's death.
For your record, this is Alex Flatley calling for KSCO Radio in Santa Cruz. And I'm trying to find out a little bit more information about this statute. I was told that you guys suspect that it was poison.
Uh-huh.
That the river was not posted.
No. There were no signs or anything. It had been in the paper, I guess, that day or the day before. Maybe a couple weeks before, before we were there, that there were a bunch of dead fish found in the stream. But we didn't know that until later. And we also saw one dead fish upstream where we were. They said that it was just a sewage spill downstream, but it's more than that, because we saw one dead fish up there before, and then Forrest drank two sips of the water. You know, he thought it was a joke. Aha, look, Dad, and two little sips before we could say, no, don't. And he started getting sick and turned green, and it looked like poisoning so far, based on all the, everything that's coming in so far.
Have you managed to get samples of the water?
Yeah, we do have some. We don't have them analyzed yet. In fact, we don't know for sure where to take them to.
Well, one thing that I can suggest, have you heard of the Surfrider Foundation?
Right, we're trying to get in touch with them. We left them messages, but, right, so far I think the best suggestion we've got about the most trustworthy source that we would go to.
Yeah. And at very least, they could direct you to someone who can conduct the test if they can.
Right.
And they are pretty good at returning calls. The sequence of events, how long was it from when he drank the water?
It was like the day before. In the afternoon, he drank the water, and he started feeling sick the next morning about 8:30. And then it was just flu-like symptoms until in the afternoon he started turning green. And the color was just really weird, and so we got concerned, and then we called the doctors. And they asked a few questions about this and that. He had another condition, a head injury, that they thought it might be also, but that's been ruled out now after the autopsy. And so anyway, he turned green. He had flu-like symptoms, then he turned green, and then he did throw up a few times. It was just, like flu, clear. He was drinking 7-Up and no blood or anything. And then the next thing that happened, he just kept feeling sick all night. John stayed up with him all night. So we know right when it happened, it was about 2 a.m., he just shut down. Yeah, it wasn't even really convulsions. He just shut down, his eyes rolled back, and he went limp. Between 2 and 3, right, this all happened. And we checked that he was breathing. I felt at least one breath come out. And so we grabbed him, ran down to the car, rushed him to the hospital. You know, we tried to do mouth-to-mouth on him some on the way. There was some breathing, but he just never responded. And then at the hospital, they tried to do CPR and breathing, and he never responded. And then he got really stiff really fast. And so they're saying that's very unusual.
Any indications as to what, any suggestions of what that might have been a result of?
Not yet. We've called the Poison Control Center. They don't know what causes symptoms like that. We just don't know, without getting the tests, really. Nobody's got any indication except that it's just, they're calling it septicemia, I guess, when the blood gets so much toxin. That's all we've got, but that's not really the cause, It's nothing about what kind of chemical, except, that it's something unusual. That's what everybody says.
Are there any companies upstream from where...
No, it's Harwood Lumber property, but it's not a mill, it's just like second growth. No recent cutting that we saw. We walked up a little ways, like maybe half a mile or something, but it's basically just timber land. A lot of people have suggested maybe somebody dumping something in the stream. That's a possibility. There's a road right up there with a gate, and it would be fairly easy to do. But We don't know at this point, and we're still waiting to see what they find out on the autopsy toxicology reports that they did in the autopsy there. But we also have our own samples, just, you know, to get an independent source on it.
Well, I am interested in following this, and when you get more information, I'd be interested in doing another story.
Okay, yeah. It could be a while, they said, you know, like six weeks or 2 months for all the reports on the autopsy to come back, which, you know, if this creek is really that dangerous, that's a long time to wait and see what it is. And there were no warnings posted. And
have they placed any warnings?
Not that I know of. You know, we informed the Environmental Health Department in Mendocino County. And, you know, we went there directly and talked to them, told them. And the Mendocino County Coroner has a detective on it, too. And the Fish and Game is, we hear they're doing an investigation as well. Yeah, not. I don't know if they know about Forrest's death yet. You know, if we just found out ourselves, really, that, you know, got the preliminary results from the autopsy. And I haven't even called the people back in Willits who we talked to, you know, which I should probably let them know, like the Environmental Center and that kind of stuff. They might go up and put up warnings, but otherwise, I don't think anybody's done it yet.
Yeah. Do you have any numbers for any of the places up there that I could call and ask them if they haven't put anything up, why they haven't?
Do you have that Willits Environmental Center number somewhere? Well, I don't have it with me, but it's called, there's an environmental center in Willits.
Okay.
Maybe you could get it through information somehow.
Do you know their area code?
707.
Okay. Is that up north or south?
North.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Well,
There was an article in the Willits News. It happened right behind their back door. So they couldn't ignore it when the fish washed down. You know, that was before Forrest. And we did go and tell them when Forrest died, but we hadn't at that point got results to know that it was probably, you know, a chemical. They also, the health department also tested for bacteria, and they say it's not that. We didn't get our samples tested in time to know, you know, independently if that's what it is. But they're saying it's not, that at this point it's looking like chemicals. And the Environmental Health Department doesn't test for chemicals. So, I guess, I don't know who's responsible there. There is sort of a hole.
Well, that seems ridiculous.
Right.
And those who would like to support John and Leslie with, you know, they're struggling with not only the death of their 5-year-old son, but the suspicious circumstances under which their son died, that at this point, with so many things being ruled out, he had mild hemophilia, that's been ruled out as a cause of death. He had a head injury about 12 days before that, that's been ruled out as a cause of death. In fact, bacterial infection has been ruled out as a cause of death. That leaves only one thing, and that's poisoning. And if indeed Forrest was poisoned by drinking some of the river water, there's a serious health hazard here that the authorities need to jump on. Many local people have been coming out. They're all touched by the death of Forrest and want to help John and Leslie any way they can. And they do need a lot of help. They need people to help network for them. They certainly need money. They need people who maybe could let them stay at their house for a couple days. To contact John and Leslie directly, call their voicemail number. It's area code 408-425-3220. And leave your name and number, how you can be helpful. And anyone who's interested in the, I'll repeat that in a minute. And anyone who's interested in the attending the funeral, it will take place sometime next week. You can call Doug Martine at Memorial Park Cemetery, and his number is 426-1601. And as soon as John and Leslie set a time and a date for the funeral, Doug can give you that information. So again, if you need to call John and Leslie, their number is 425-3220. And the community really needs to rally behind John and Leslie with this, after this terrible tragedy, the loss of young Forrest.
Earlier in the show, you heard Linda LeMaster talking about the hospital experience of Lotus Maynard, formerly head of the Santa Cruz Union of the Homeless, mother, actually grandmother now. Here she is talking about her own experiences in a phone interview I had with her yesterday.
Hi.
And you're going to tell us what happened to you yesterday. Was it yesterday?
Yeah, yesterday. I hurt my leg and I went to the hospital. Emergency room.
Mm-hmm. About what time was this?
Well, it was dark. It was evening.
Okay, this is on Friday evening. And you went in an ambulance?
Yes.
This is because you were experiencing some pain?
Regular pain in my leg. I couldn't walk or stand.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I had to be dragged on a rug to the bathroom. I couldn't stand.
Mm-hmm.
So I could just crawl up and try to go to the bathroom.
Right.
Now, the guys in the ambulance were wonderful. They were very careful, very reassuring, and very gentle. And the three of them deserve a lot of commendation. They got me out of those, down the stairs and around corners and out of there without hurting me at all.
Yeah, this was from Linda's place?
Yeah.
Which is right, okay.
I don't know what the ambulance company was, but I remember their names were Jeff, Jacob, and Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
And they were particularly helpful. And I got to the hospital, and I was...
Dominican Hospital.
I was greeted by a physician's assistant who was very helpful. He was really nice and really helpful and had x-rays taken. The x-ray technician was very nice, and then they took me back to a cubicle, and I was very cold. And I asked the nurse, whose name was Jane Wells, for a blanket, and she reached over and got a little light blanket and put it over on top of me, and I said, well, don't you heat the blankets anymore, because I was really cold.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, we're not going to bother giving you a heated blanket, because you're not going to stay. And then she left me alone. You know, I was going to get home, and I said, well, I didn't know, I couldn't walk. And they had put a brace on my knee, but they had told me to stay off my leg and not walk, and I couldn't stay. I still couldn't stand on it. It still hurt.
Which knee was this?
Right knee.
Right.
They said it looked like it might be a sprain, but it was too swollen to tell where it was sprained.
Mm-hmm. And still is swollen?
It still is swollen. They've recommended that I put ice on it, but it's really hard to get up and get ice when you can't stand on the darn thing.
Right.
Yeah, the apartment here, the hotel room is all on one floor, which does help me, but the passageway in the hall and the bathroom is too narrow to support a wheelchair, so I have to try and hobble in there. We're using a walker, and it's really, really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
The brace that she put on, the nurse put on, fell off as I was coming into the motel room walking towards the bathroom, with assistance from two people holding me up so I could get to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you think it was incompetently put on?
I don't think it was put on right. Linda said that they told her that she shouldn't even have a foam rubber brace around a knee that was in that condition.
Mm-hmm.
So,
who made the decision to put this brace on your knee?
I'm not sure. I assume it was okay by the doctor, Dr. Buckman, who at one point came over to examine me by touching my knee and said, "Did it hurt here? Did it hurt here?" And I said, "Yes, it hurts in this area." And he then grabbed my leg and pulled it so hard, it hurt so bad I couldn't breathe.
Right.
And I screamed, I guess.
Right.
And he just walked away. And the nurse to take care of me, who was really rude. She kept saying things like, "Well, how do you plan to get home? Can you get someone come and get you?" And I said, "The only car I've got is a camper. I can't get up in the truck."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Well, you can go home in a taxi." And I said, "Well, I can't afford a taxi." And she said, "Well, finally, after arguing with me, she said, "Well, we'll send you home this once, but don't respect it again."
What was the name of this woman?
Name Wells.
And that's all we have time for this week on Bathrobes Pierre's Broadside, Civil Rights for the Poor on 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. Tune in next week at this time, 11 o'clock on Sunday mornings. It's possible we may be extending the show for an hour, depending on the choice of the transmitter here. Michael Sheridan, a homeless activist with HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, has composed an entire tape, what he calls Psycho Cruise. We're hoping that that will come on next, or at least sometime in the next week here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. What it's like to be poor and in your van on the streets, a pungent political analysis from Michael Sheridan. If you'd like to catch the phone numbers or maybe miss them, call me up at 423-4833 if any numbers I presented on this show you couldn't quite get to a pencil and paper in time. I'd be happy to give them to you. Again, my number is 423-4833-423-HUF. It's also a number you should call if you want to have any reactions to the show put on next time, or if you have any complaints, concerns, or information you want to bring to the general community about police abuse, folks who are poor being mistreated, or just what it's like to be out there on the streets that you think should be known by the broader community. Thanks for being with me this week. Tune in again next week, and hopefully by that time we'll have another issue of the homeless newsletter, the Street Shit Sheet. Certainly there should be an issue of Street Spirit, the San Francisco homeless newspaper on the streets, which you can pick up downtown in front of the Cinema 9 Theater. In the meantime, on down to the Vets Memorial Building, noon to midnight tonight.